Well, good evening, everybody. My name is Tony Giddens, Director of the LSE. On behalf of the LSE, I'd like to welcome everyone here this evening, and especially welcome our distinguished guest, Harry Evans. I've got more than one reason to thank Harry for being here tonight. Naturally, I'm pleased that he is here, but he's done an awful lot to help the LSE in New York. He and his wife, Tina Brown, have held several events to which they've invited me, and they invited numerous of the New York glitterati. And these events have proved enormously helpful to the LSE in profile raising, fundraising in the United States. So even though Harry has no direct connection really with the LSE, it's a wonderful thing for us that he's been so helpful in helping us in the United States. Harry Evans' accomplishments are legion, and so I've written them down very briefly here because I think most people in the audience will know them. Before moving to the US, Harry was editor of the Sunday Times from 1967 to 1981. He was editor of the Times between 1981 to 1982. The Insight team that he nurtured at the Sunday Times became something of a newspaper legend. He was president of Random House Group from 1990 to 1997. Last year, he published an already celebrated book, The American Century. When he arrived here, he gave me this thing just now about the American Century. Do you know if you want to, people thought it was good? All they thought it was superb, brilliant, magnificent, absorbing, powerful, wonderful, impressive. And it goes on in that vein. And these are the negative reviews, I think.
Yes. Yeah, so fair-minded.
I understand that he plans to write two further books on American history in the next couple of years. Harry has influenced the lives of many people. Just to give you an example, one is Bob Worcester. Bob Worcester is the head of MORI, the polling organization, and he's also on the LSE Court of Governors, the ruling body of the LSE. Naturally, I invited him to come to this lecture. And he sent me this reply. Thank you, dear Tony, thank you very much for thinking of me in connection with the Harry Evans lecture and dinner. I would dearly love to come, but alas, I will be in the Caribbean. Hard life for some. Harry, as one of my icons, was instrumental in whatever success I've had in the polling field, as he invented me. I was sitting at my desk one day in 1975 and the telephone rang and a voice said, I am Harry Evans and I am editor of the Sunday Times. This is still Bob Worcester speaking. I said, yes, Mr. Evans, I know you are editor of the Sunday Times. What can I do for you? He replied, my colleagues tell me we should get you to do our polling. How soon can you come to see me? I'll be there in 20 minutes, I said. I was, and I'm still working today for Times newspapers, thanks to Harry Evans. So let me again welcome him here tonight. And the title of his lecture tonight is The American Experience, Media Pluses and Minuses. Welcome, Harry Evans.
I said, individually, you may be all very nice, but collectively, you look like a PhD oral. So if I stumble occasionally, please forgive me. I feel very honored to see so many distinguished people here tonight, some of them as gray as me. It was suggested I might reflect on the American media over the last 100 years. I'm not quite that old, and I've heard nothing yet official about my application for immortality. But I can just about manage personal observations over 50 years, and I hope 50 will do. 100 would take twice as long, so please say yes. Anyone who speaks at LSE, I hear, had better declare himself and come clean about his historical biases and prejudices. The most relevant for me is that looking at the American press, I've always had in mind the question posed by the editor of the New York Herald in the 1840s. James Gordon Bennett. What is to stop a newspaper, said Bennett, from being the greatest organ of social reform? Well, Bennett was a cross-eyed editor. He ran the richest and most sensational newspaper, full of sexy murders and Wall Street panics. So he had a highly developed sense of paradox, as you can see from the question. But the question's valid. Incidentally, can you all hear me? Okay. The question's valid. Well, I've now gathered enough ink stains in the United States over 15 years since I went there after a little local incident here in London in 1982. But I first caught America midway in the century when I crossed on the steamship Franconia, refighting World War II with a German philosopher with whom I played chess every day until we landed in New York and woke up and there it all was. I was a reporter there on the Manchester Evening News, bound for the universities of Chicago and Stanford, and I'd somehow been cunning enough to convince, as one or two of my colleagues also were later, the Harkness Fellowships that I would benefit from 2 years of study and a lot of travel in the United States. It was in Chicago at the university, as I approached at the L, that I had my first lesson in the conversion of an Englishman into living in America, when I bought a ticket at the L, the subway, and I said to the man, "Thank you, thank you, thank you very much." And he said, "Did you say something, asshole?" Just thanks, sir, I said. "You have to call people sir. It's in the Constitution. If they do a menial job, you immediately call them sir." I said, "Just thanks, sir." "Oh, you're welcome," was the reward. Well, I dare say this talk, if it ever gets leaked back across the Atlantic, if not too much of a mixed metaphor, we'll get the same kind of "did you say something" response, because it's critical, by and large, of the American media. I came home in 1958 then in awe of much of what I saw in the regional papers, the local papers, which I visited and worked on in 40 states. They seemed to be answering Bennett's question very well, and they were certainly not hindered by officialdom in the way the British newspapers were in those bad old days, and I'm told those bad old days no longer exist, which I take with a grain of salt. Indeed, the Americans were spoiled by abundance. The prairies of newsprint on which reporters were allowed to graze were too vast to encourage concise writing. And anyway, readers soon got lost. The New York Times to this day still continues to jump a story from page one to page B section and then onto the C section, which is the real source of the high rate of divorce in New York, as people squabble across the breakfast tables. What impressed me most was the relative freedom from an external restraint, the access, the status of the journalist, the genuine commitment on most papers to a community's well-being, except on the question of minority rights, which I want to return to in a moment, and everyone's appetite for technical innovation, which we did not have in Britain in the 50s. I kept telling them all that they owed a lot to the madness of King George III. In their subjugation and rebellion, Americans came to appreciate the critical importance of a free press. And if the torch lit by the First Amendment, as it was carried and forward and justified by performance down the years by many visionary editors and writers, and by the American bar. It's a curious fact that the lawyers have been the best allies of the journalists in the struggle for openness, which by and large has not been true of Britain. Here, it seems to me, the legal profession has held itself aloof from the Grub Street rabble, except when excited by Mr. Micawber's pecuniary considerations. Why is this? The Americans were not content with the First Amendment. The freedom from prior restraint, which the half-free British press still does not enjoy, had to be established against jealously guarded states' rights. Often overlooked here is the power of the states. It was not won until 1931 in the case Near v. Minnesota, when J. Near and Howard Guilford persuaded the Supreme Court that the state of Minnesota acted unconstitutionally in closing their newspaper. What had they done? They'd used the most vile language to attack Jewish gangsters in Minnesota, for which the paper had been shut down, it being argued that that was offensive speech. But the priority for free speech, even when foully expressed, was neatly summed up by Chief Justice Hughes in the Supreme Court, who wrote this, and we all have to remember it. The rights of the best of men are secured only as the rights of the vilest and most abhorrent are protected. It takes a bit of accepting that doctrine sometime when you look at some of the gossip columns, but that is what Chief Justice Hughes said. Now, the appeal against the ban, there was something else I want to talk about, actually, now I think about it. Guilford and Jay could never have afforded to fight a case all the way to the Supreme Court. They ran a kind of scandal sheet in which they tried to catch politicians in a procreative position in the back of a car and then blackmail them not to publish it. That was their idea of investigative journalism. But they couldn't have afforded it. In fact, it was Guilford who gave us the classic definition: a journalist is a reporter out of a job. True. The appeal against the ban could only have taken place because it was financed by Colonel McCormick of the Chicago Tribune, right-wing newspaper. Then there was then and remains today a much greater sense of community among ownership and journalists in the United States. At the Daily News recently, we won an easement of press harassment by the cops because the Times and television joined our campaign to get the police to do what they were supposed to do, which was to give access. In 1981, when Parliament was considering legislation to reform the laws of contempt here, following the Sunday Times thalidomide victory at Strasbourg, engineered by James Evans and Tony Lester, only the Times bothered to report and comment in any detail on the subsequent legislation enforced on the government by the European decision. I recall expressing some irritation about this to a very, very high-minded national editor. And he said, "Well, we've left it alone because it's your story." But the bill was to infect the entire press and the common interest in not letting a scandal lie protected by archaic laws. It wasn't a press matter, it was a public matter, what kind of bill emerged from that Strasbourg decision. Another national daily editor came up to me and explained the same thing, and finally, after I'd argued with him, he wrote an editorial making some very good points on the day the bill was about to be signed and not a comma could be changed. According to Hugo Young, in a very fine lecture to the British Institute of Human Affairs recently, the very same thing has been happening with the Freedom of Information Bill, with only The Guardian among the national papers, UK Press Gazette, giving it any serious comment and scrutiny. Now, I know that the regionals are examining the local government access and are making a very good point, but why is it? What are the editors afraid of from joining in? It's not collusion to act together in the common interest, openly and declaring it. Why do they hang back? And then, of course, you know what will happen when the bill goes through and it's not as good as it is. Then they'll all wake up and say, "How did this bill go through? Why is it? What is wrong with the editors who won't join in and act with their own independent minds? They don't even have to talk to anybody. They ought to take an interest." The easy access to official information, which I saw in the 50s, incidentally, was before the Freedom of Information Acts of 1966 in 1974, where journalists, and I emphasize again, lawyers, were allied to great effect, reinforcing the traditions of the muckrakers. So far, so historically good. But I brooded long then, and still do, over this question. Freedom is a good in itself, but does freedom of the press lose its moral justification when it's not used to defend the oppressed, or at the very least bring their oppression to light? In America, when I was there in the 50s, it was no surprise to find that the southern newspapers did not report the conditions of the blacks. And as far as television was concerned, the blacks might have well been on Mars. That was no surprise. The most liberal papers only preached the revolutionary idea of calling a Negro Mr. or capitalizing Negro. In fact, I remember standing in the warm sunshine in Lexington, Mississippi with Hazel Brandon Smith, and she was in a terrible ordeal because of this putting the word Mr. in front of a Negro accused of crime. She finally won a Pulitzer Prize. All right, you may say, that was the Southern way. And I asked myself, well, who will wield Excalibur? Who will raise the sword in defense of this terrible oppression? And the answer, nobody. It was stuck firmly in the rock. Nationally, with the exception of a few diligent correspondents, the most respected liberal organs like the New York Times, Time, Newsweek, the New York Herald Tribune, and the Washington Post, for years lackadaisically portrayed the fight for human rights as one more mildly amusing political game with regular winners, losers, and trailers. I was in Mississippi shortly after the 1955 murder of the 14-year-old Emmett Till. The grinning acquittal of his two killers, which was customary in those days, did get a little attention. But 2 months later, a white Mississippi cotton gin manager called Elmer Kimball shot to death a black gas attendant, Clinton Melton, without any cause whatsoever. And David Halberstam was almost alone in giving his acquittal any attention at all. And this is what a local said when I was there. Any Peckerwood who wants can go shoot himself one, meaning nigger, and we'll free him. Any Peckerwood, there's an open season on Negroes right now. And so there was. Editorials, however, in the national papers, the ones I've described, warned constantly against extremism on both sides, equating non-violent activists and the white mob. This passion for thinking the truth lies in the middle of an argument when it very often lies at the extreme and not in the middle of an argument. There came to be the same schizophrenia and the same, if I might say, preference for a corrupt middle way that would be repeated in Vietnam. The editors and publishers at BASE steadfastly refused to believe what their reporters in the field were telling them. Time magazine rewrote critical dispatches from Saigon to follow the official line. In the civil rights struggle, the leading powers of America's free press seemed in a constant state of fret that their fellow citizens were demanding rights that they themselves had taken for granted as the air they breathed. Thus, the New York Times warned against extending the freedom rides in the summer of 1961. And this is what the Times said. The freedom riders are challenging not only long-held customs, but passionately held feelings. Non-violence that deliberately provokes violence is a logical contradiction. Well, when you think about it, that puts on a level of moral equivalency the wielder of the lead pipe and the recipient of the blow. The Times gave the Freedom Riders no more than token coverage for a long time. Time magazine called the movement a confused crusade and sought out every black leader willing to criticize the involvement of Martin Luther King's SNCC. When Martin Luther King's movement was stalemated in Georgia by the segregationists adopting more subtle tactics against the Christian leaders, the New York Herald Tribune called it a devastating blow for King, as opposed to, say, a devastating blow for every American professing to love freedom. Those were the terms of the debate. And it's a curious comment that one of the most celebrated victories, which we all know about, in the press in America, Sullivan v. New York Times, in 1960, concerned a protest over black oppression. But it was not for anything that the New York Times reported or wrote in an editorial. It's to the Times' credit, of course, that it fought and won that expensive case. A very, very heroic action on their part. But the action came from an advertisement, not from a reported piece. one signed by Eleanor Roosevelt, Nat King Cole and Jackie Robinson, criticizing the commissioner of police in Birmingham and the state of Alabama for violating the Constitution, which they were. I often wondered how fast the things would have moved if the news and opinion pages had changed earlier. I don't mean changed in men's souls. You can't change that by legislation. It takes a little longer. But what they might have achieved if what was legally permissible or legally impermissible had been changed sooner, like the right to vote freely, the right not to be beaten up when you go to register. It only changed after the Birmingham bomb outrage and the March on Washington in 1963, and then television came along and filmed the hosing of the women and children in Birmingham and the Children's Crusade. But that had been a lost decade in the freest environment in the world. So the question, what is to stop a newspaper being the greatest organ of social reform? Not external restraint in this case. I can only guess that news editors of the day did not feel any moral imperative. They were the prisoners of history, captive to the notion that news was something that happened and you, quote, objectively reported and never got involved. They were certainly then well inoculated by tradition and training to the idea of church and state. News run by one editor, opinion by another, a diffusion that mitigated against campaigning. Black rights were just not on the agenda. Now, if freedom of the press is not exercised, not only is it merely a platitude, merely a piece of rhetoric, I argue it's a betrayal of a public trust. And of course, I want to say straight away, not all our impediments are external. There are the limitations imposed by our own imagination and skill, and we have to recognize them. Come back across the Atlantic for 5 minutes. Nobody bothered to pay any attention to the discrimination practiced against Catholics in Northern Ireland for years and years and years. At the Sunday Times in 1967, we did run a fairly biggish feature called John Bull's Political Slum. But having exposed the sore, we did nothing further, and I count it as one of my great failures. If we had put it on the agenda, as we could have done, with that staff that we had, which was so terrific, modest reforms in Ulster could have followed, and modest reforms at that stage might well have averted the violence and the descent into the nightmare, which continues to this day. John Whale did a fine job reporting the excesses of internment, and Edward Heath moved to end it, the excesses. But it was all too late to avoid the nightmare. So if the press is to fulfill Bennett's role, it needs freedom, yes, but it needs vision and acceptance, an unashamed acceptance of its moral purpose, and not a snigger at the idea, and a recognition that to meet Bennett's case, it may be of little use to print the truth once. But when the immediate cause seems to be lost, even when the immediate cause seems to be lost and a newspaper or television is in almost in a minority, I think the effort, there's virtue in the effort, even by the few. And the example I'd like to give is this. There are many press commentators in the United States and here and in the literature have suggested that the failure of the American press in the McCarthy years was exactly the same as the civil rights. That the press failed. In fact, it is true that the wire services and most of the newspapers didn't check on the statements that McCarthy was making. Incidentally, he was quite right. There were far more active communists in the United States, and the American Communist Party was a tool of the Soviet Union. But Joe McCarthy never found a single communist for all his lather. And so we know that it was built on lies and fiction and so on. And many lives were ruined. But in the 50s, when I traveled, I did see Excalibur raised to effect. The New York Times, which I've criticized over civil rights legislation, the Washington Post, the Milwaukee Journal, the Reporter, the New Yorker, Ed Morrow, I.F. Stone, and a few others all put their hands to the hilt, all in their isolated way. They were not a conspiracy. not even a coalition. It was a spontaneous movement. It wasn't pro-communist, it was pro-America. It was a spontaneous resistance to the new despotism that included many disparate individuals and groups, the thousands who fought and faced loyalty hearings and won 90% of the time, because again, the judges, the American judges, built new case law consistently in their favor. And of course, finally, Marshall Harlan restored full freedom of speech for communists and dissenters by restricting unprotected speech to actual incitement to lawless action. So these liberal anti-communist bodies, the Americans for Democratic Action, the Americans Veterans Committee, the ACLU, the Defamation League, the NAACP, all were heartened when the best in the press did not lack all conviction. Of course, the event didn't save many individuals who lost their lives. Discourse was stultified. Colleges were demoralized. But America did not, in the end, pay for the Cold War by sacrificing its civil liberties, as George Kennan feared it might. What happened, well described by David Lilienthal, what happened was when the virus entered the bloodstream, the antibodies resisted it sufficiently that when, as it does when a major threat to health comes along, and so the experience of living through the McCarthy and witch hunts and nightmare plays stimulated the antibodies, and when the Vietnam War divided America, the dissenters could build on the barricade built by McCarthy's opponents, and the dissent in America and Vietnam was a wonderful thing to behold. Contrary to the common belief, incidentally, it's common belief is that the American press lost the war in Vietnam. Let me just say a word about that. Nixon said it was the first war in history in which our media were more friendly to our enemies than our allies. In fact, until 67, 68, the war was reported from the point of view of the government as a clean war with little shooting, little killing, or little death. And throughout the 50s and most of the 60s, there was a broad consensus in support of the domino theory. Cronkite's famous disaffection didn't take place until 1968, when the public opinion already started to turn. The print heroes Halberstam and Sheehan exposed the corruptions of Saigon, but until 1967, even these fine reporters backed the war's objectives and argued against withdrawal. Like everyone else, including the press corps in Vietnam, they wanted the United States to stay and win. In fact, Johnson said of the editorials in the Washington Post, they were so supportive they were worth 50 divisions. So throughout television and the press over the Vietnam for nearly a decade, Excalibur stayed in the rock. Since those days, American journalism has enlarged its freedom. Meanwhile, UK progress has been, if it's been a march forward, as I'm sometimes told it is, it's been reminiscent of Berlioz's funeral march. Lots of shuffling of feet and solemn noises, but not much ground covered. In America, meanwhile, out of the civil rights struggles, there emerged Sullivan, out of Watergate, the Second Freedom of Information Act, out of Vietnam, the Pentagon Papers reinforcement against censorship. And these are victories won by stalwart newsmen and women and their managers, and won every month in the regional newspapers in America by the smaller papers. A beacon for the world, though Sullivan, I went to a conference recently on Sullivan, interesting thing. Sullivan, it is now widely recognized as being abused, as if it sanctioned intrusion into private lives, which it plainly did not. And at this conference, those of you who know Floyd Abrams will be surprised to hear that even Floyd Abrams, the most brilliant First Amendment lawyer in the United States, joined in the note of regret and anxiety about the way pollution justifying criticism of public officials has been diluted and distorted to justify the most gross intrusions into private lives. So Sullivan, which is sometimes used in British arguments over here, one should be very careful about it, because there's a turn of opinion in the United States because of the mendacity and ferocity of the intrusion into private lives. The question remains whether the opportunities of the free press have been seized in the United States. And alas, a thousand flowers have hardly bloomed. The common thread seems to be a tendency to consensus, to conformity, to a flattening of the landscape, a homogeneity of opinion and approach, as uninspiring as the moles that ring the cities. Now, I'm not suggesting that consensus is always wrong, and I do recognize the individual brilliance of reporters on the Post and the Times and the Opinion and the New Republic, and very occasionally on PBS and Discovery. But the trend is clearly there. Now, the view on the left is that it's all a consequence of monopoly and big business, this evenness of opinion. The monopoly can be exaggerated because though there's a monopoly of print almost everywhere, it's challenged by radio, television, and of course increasingly by the web, which I'll come to. And it is also true that there are some newspaper groups who have distinguished themselves only by the degree of their cowardice. And I'm thinking particularly of the expulsion of Bill Kovach from the Atlanta Constitution. But there's not much evidence, or at least there's just as much evidence of big corporations digging deep to fight the malefactors of great wealth, to quote Teddy Roosevelt. Just take McGraw-Hill and the way it stood up for Steve Shepard in his great fight against the law and against business. But a lack of dissonance there certainly is, and I'd just like to give you a couple of two or three instances. I'm watching the clock very carefully here. When I got to Washington in 1984, I thought I'd entered a journalistic Valhalla, as I thought tonight I'd entered an academic Valhalla. The streets were paved with information, LexisNexis to the world's libraries. It was the most amazing. Now it looks child's play. And yet, this is give you an example. Despite the Pulitzer Prizes and all the other things that were going, these are two or three examples of what I mean by conformative opinion. In 1985, Gorbachev announced, he was then a semi-villain in the United States, and here too, that he was unilaterally ending nuclear testing, and it would begin on August the 6th, the 40th anniversary of Hiroshima. Now, I expected that cessation of nuclear tests would be reported and examined as an interesting way to stop the then still escalating arms race. What happened? All the leading reporters regurgitated the line of the administration, which was embarrassed by Gorbachev's initiative. Not once, but four times on the CBS Evening News, my good friend Leslie Stahl described the ban as propaganda. The New York Times, the Washington Post, and the Los Angeles Times all carelessly described Gorbachev's moratorium not as a deed, but as a proposal. And then for months, the press totally ignored the test ban proposal. In the meantime, the Russians continued not to test nuclear weapons. I went to see President Reagan about it in the White House. I got absolutely nowhere in trying to get some kind of acknowledgement of what was happening. The peace activists, so-called, collected a million signatures, and Jesse Jackson was denounced as a traitor for actually going to Geneva to present these signatures for the moratorium on nuclear testing to continue. Bill Moyers, the darling of liberal America, called Jackson a communist dupe for collecting signatures to end the test ban. Not one of the networks mentioned. I find it hard to believe this. Are you sure, Harry? Absolutely sure. I checked it again and again. Not one of the networks mentions that the Soviets had actually stopped testing. And Gorbachev kept trying. He ended years of Soviet stalling, as he should have done, and finally offered to allow inspectors on Soviet soil. Just that's news. The Russians are going to allow inspectors. It's been the stumbling block for years with the nuclear test ban. Dan Rather goes on television, well, a little pre-Christmas propaganda in the air. That's it. Not a single newspaper examined the history of the test ban negotiations, not one. Over an 18-month period when the evil empire conducted not a single nuclear test, the United States did 20. We now know, of course, that this fellow Gorbachev was telling the truth, making a real initiative to end the arms race and the Cold War. Now, as Frederick Maitland said, it's hard to remember that events in the past were once long in the future. Think about what will happen today in some similar kind of situation when the conventional political position is challenged and there's somehow a national sense that it would be unpatriotic not to look into it. The same thing happened when the United States Navy shot down an Iranian airliner with civilians on it. Every station, TV station, every station and newspaper went into this patriotic mode. It was an accident, you know, it was a tragic accident, but they tried to suggest it was the Iranian Airlines fault, some clever move by the Iranians to get themselves into harm's way and embarrass the United States. It was ridiculous. Jesse Jackson, again, was the only politician who suggested it was the case for regret and compensation. George Bush went along with the line that it wasn't the Americans' fault, which in the end, of course, they admitted that it was. And eventually the truth came out, but not before the press heard a pounded truth into the ground. Now, I understand the press in every country feels a strain when issues of apparent patriotism arise, but the effect is all the more discomforting in the United States when there's so much individual freedom, but such a limited range of independent voices. Now, what is the root of this conformity? And I can give you many instances of it. The size of the country has weighed against the national distribution of newspapers. Wall Street Journal, New York Times, USA Today are now national, but by and large, this is a new phenomenon. Perhaps it's something to do with the American manufacturing genius for standardization carrying through into journalism. In any event, there's nothing like the variety of the British press. Thank God, say some Americans. But here, at least, with so many dailies, national dailies, and so many varying kinds of paper, from the tabloids, the broadsheets, and so on, I never thought I would say, as I do now, that this variety to me seems well worth cherishing and something the United States would be better off with. Come now to the Clinton era. The press, and I emphasize that especially means network, cable, and local television, has performed in exactly the same manner I've described these earlier instances. The full history of the impeachment has yet to be written, but it's already clear that in a frenzy without precedent in American history, the press lost all capacity for self-discipline and abandoned time-honored standards for which it has suffered now calamitously in public esteem. The press in the Clinton impeachment was manipulated by a variety of people with different motives, some interested in making money from books, and a number, which we can identify, determined by any means whatsoever to bring down Clinton. And what we have seen, this has now been interestingly examined by Jeffrey Toobin, a lawyer and journalist, what we've seen is the use of the legal procedures in the United States to displace political results, to change the election which got Clinton, to get him out by any legal means whatsoever. There was a confluence of influences at work in the way the press behaved. I'm going to give you one example in a minute. First of all, everybody wanted to be Woodward and Bernstein. When I discussed it with Ben Bradley, he said he was horrified. He said, we always had two sources. We always checked. I don't know what's happened, why people are rushing out like this. There's the Paley effect. William Haley said it would be a very bad day for television when the news division became a profit center. Well, that's what happened. The news division became a profit center, and it was a very bad day for journalism. The cleverness of some of the people in trying to bring Clinton down was really, they completely outfoxed the newspapers in a way I'll describe. But just give me one instance of the kind of frenzy with the web that happened. I call this Caught in the Act. You remember the headline, Caught in the Act. What does it bring to mind? Lewinsky and Clinton, caught in the act. I don't want you to get too excited about this. I just want to go through it carefully. A lawyer, Victoria Tensing, in Washington, is having breakfast with her husband, a former independent prosecutor. There's a phone call. The phone call says, a friend, this person was a friend of a friend who'd been at the White House, and she thinks that this friend knows somebody who saw them in the act. Clinton and Lewinsky. Victoria Tensing rings up the independent prosecutor, Ken Starr. Her husband goes to lunch with the Dallas Morning Herald reporter called Jackson. Right? Victoria Tensing having run Ken Starr leaks the news to Jackie Dunn of ABC television that there's some story about a woman seeing them caught in the act. at the lunch with the Dallas guy, her husband says, and my wife told me, very interesting, there's a story about a woman who saw them when the actor was in the White House. Dallas said, I've heard the same thing from ABC television. Christ, two sources. So then Jackson gets back to the office and he calls up Victoria Tensley. In the meantime, Victoria's had a conversation with the source who says, I'm sorry, it's nonsense. There was no such person. She was just making it up. So Victoria says to the Dallas Morning Herald, I'm sorry, there's no story. The guy was just making it up. Wait a minute, says the Dallas guy. He rings up Ken Starr's office and says, yes, we've heard that story. So he thinks he's got another source, so he goes with it, rushes it out on the web. It's picked up by the Associated Press, a source yesterday. Larry King picks it up. Rivera picks it up. And the next day, even in my own paper, we've got the heading, caught in the act. Sources said yesterday. Of course, the Dallas Herald had to apologize. What was happening was that news sources were reporting other news sources as the justification for a story neither of them had investigated. Now, we know that Clinton did things that all of us here would never do in a million years and be caught. But that doesn't make the point. The point is this was a fiction. And it shows you how these things can happen. If you take Jeffrey Toobin's book, what he shows, it's very interesting, it's called A Vast Conspiracy. It's not out here yet, but it confirms the judgments I've been giving you, that using the legal means to get Clinton in an unconstitutional manner, this is what Toobin, and by the way, the same thing happened with Hillary Clinton. I was lunching with a man, I'm not going to go into too many details, but let's just say close to the Starr. And I was told, we're going to nail Hillary Clinton, she's going to be indicted next week. Bill Sapphire had a blizzard of lies. She was never indicted. She was never even close to being indicted. It was all part of the prosecutorial spin. In the United States, not uninhibited by the laws of contempt as we are, the prosecutors used the press as a tool. This was a classic example of they were using the press as a tool to intimidate, to frighten, to persuade the jurors, to leak it out round that way, and to influence public opinion. And this is how Jeffrey Toobin concludes. The most astonishing fact in this story may be this one. In spite of his consistently reprehensible behavior, Clinton was by comparison the good guy in this struggle. The president's adversaries appeared literally consumed with hatred for him. The higher the stakes, the smaller they acted. They were willing to trample all standards of fairness, not to mention the Constitution, in their efforts to drive him from office to achieve by legal means what they were not able to achieve in the electoral process. The discouraging thing in Toobin's book is the documentation of how the press was a handmaiden, indeed an essential weapon, because what would happen when they wanted to plant a story, they wouldn't put it out themselves, the Jacksons and the other people conspiring against Clinton. They would find a newspaper man and say to him, you know, this would make a great book, you'd get $100,000 for this book from Random House. Bet you if that fellow Evans is still throwing money away like crazy. And so the story came out in the press without the normal distancing effect, and then, as I say, was picked up by other papers. It's just like the 30s when that man, Franklin Roosevelt, was so reviled. It's extraordinary that even great newspapers like the Times, the Washington Post, would print that stuff. And I talked to Joe Lelefeld about it, and he actually, the following day, stopped the Times. A very honourable editor, Joe Lelefeld, stopped the Times from taking ABC News as a source. He stopped it. So it showed what could be done. The amazing thing is that all the scandals of the Clinton era, Whitewater, Travelgate, Filegate, all the serious stuff was investigated by Starr, was investigated by Jay Stevens, the leading Republican lawyer for a law firm brought in by the Resolution Trust Corporation, and not one of these was found to be credible. But here's a shocking thing. I've just given a bouquet to the New York Times. Let me just say, the New York Times and the Washington Post, both of them ran major stories on the front page about the Whitewater land scandal, of which there isn't one. And then when Jay Stevens, the leading prominent Republican who outraged Stephanopoulos by being appointed, when Jay Stevens' report acquitted the Clintons of any improprieties in that land deal, in fact, they lost money on it, neither the Times nor the Washington Post put it on the front page. It was buried, small, inside. Well, I can go on. I've got so many more instances. I don't want to go on. The Arlington Cemetery story, which was again a fiction, completely dominated the press, that he'd sold graves for money, which he hadn't. And I love the comment, the defense by that very funny columnist, Maureen Dowd, who says, yes, it was right to run it. It was the kind of thing she expected of Clinton, to sell graves for profit. So they ran the story, because not because he'd done it, but because it was the kind of thing they expected him to do. This is what you might call self-fulfilling prophecy. Cokie Roberts on ABC News made exactly the same thing. Well, it's the kind of thing Clinton would do. That's why we ran with it. We didn't check it. It was a total fiction fed out by the Moonies from Washington. Fictions fed out by the Moonies from Washington. Here's the motto. Verdicts first, facts later. What next? As Yogi Berra said, it's tough to make predictions, especially about the future. But there's some ground for hope. The misuse of freedom, the transition from investigation to inquisition, the descent into nastiness, has been so lamentable that there is now a host of really distinguished journalists who do not lack conviction and the fullest passionate intensity to do something. To name a few, David Broder, Mike Wallace, Robert McNeil, Ben Bagdikian, Jim Squires, Abe Rosenthal, Bill Kovacs, Adam Gotnick, James Fellows, Osborne Elliott, Ray Cave. Organizations like the Freedom Forum, the Media Studies Center, the Pew Foundation, Molly Parnas, George Polk and Annenberg and other bodies are giving millions away to millions to try and raise the standards by identifying good journalism. And I think, despite my somewhat lachrymose story, we're coming to the tipping point in the United States, an accumulation of concern among the public as much as among the professionals that will stimulate America's infinite capacity to remake itself. And then finally, there's the galvanizing effect of technology. Yes, the web has produced some terrible pseudo-journalism, some frantic nonsense of the kind I've described, like the Wall Street Journal rushing a story on the web, which the next morning it has to correct in the newspaper. Just to give you a couple of examples of the invigorating effect of the web, Slate and Salon are well worth WW clipping into. And I think we have some hope of alleviating, through the web, the packed journalism and consensus mentality I've described. In 1976, after seeing the first computerized newspaper in Detroit, I thought I was very prescient. I came back to London, and one of my colleagues here tonight will confirm it, arguing with the NUJ Chapel that we must have access to the computer, not simply so that we could type, but so that we could have access to data and use the computer for research. I thought I was prescient, thinking, I even actually said in an Institute of Stations lecture, we were going to have access to libraries, we're going to have access to information undreamed of. I had no idea that we would have access of the kind we've got, millions talking to millions, sometimes gibberish, but millions talking to gibberish, to 2 billion on the web, in real time through hypertext and so on. And the good news from America, I conclude, is that what the cybernauts call the dead tree daily. The dead tree daily is just about recovering its nerve from the electronic shock of the new. Enterprise come naturally to America as manifest in the choices in television. I used to say, we don't need any more than 2 televisions. Wrong. The television choices in the United States are far superior to here. ABC, the Discovery Channel, the History Channel, the public television channels, the CNN, the constant news channels, they are an example, I think, despite some lapses of quality, of America at its best. And then the amazingly rapid growth of websites and e-commerce, and the people who run the fixed-time telecasts and newspapers and magazines are recognizing that it's not enough to build a comparable website, simply delivering old media in a new form. What's happening, and it's really being encouraging, the real question is now being addressed, not how can the web give us quicker journalism, but how can we get better journalism? How can the interactive technologies be employed to make the journalism more effective, more comprehensive, more in touch, more relevant, through community rooms, through inter-research projects? I'm going to give you an example just very, very quickly. The San Jose Mercury News has been posting court transcripts and even the sounds, including a section of a wiretap of a drug dealer when it was a controversial issue. So you can get the sound, you get the vision. NBC's magazine Dateline had a feature about dangerous roads in America based on three bad roads. The program invited viewers to log on to the MSNBC site to learn about roads in their community. When they did, they could enter their zip code, and within seconds, they got a complete rundown of all the dangerous roads, all the dangerous corners, all the dangerous turns in their own area, where accidents occurred between 1992 and 1995. 68,000 people logged in just for that. Money Magazine followed up a tax proposal by enabling people to just chip in their own incomes and see exactly, in an instant, how it would affect them. And now, on Friday, I was described to me by a leading electronic entrepreneur, the voice activated, where you will come to the computer, this is actually happening now, coming to the computer, activating it by voice and saying, a person will come on, let's say it's Tony. Tony, will you drop into four or five chat rooms for me on the health service and find out how 2 million people think the health services are going in the United States, and give me a summary of everything that's repeated four or five times by about in a half an hour. And it can be done, and it will be done, and it's going to be a real positive enrichment, provided we understand the remaining moral imperatives of journalism. Freedom and technology. Excalibur, I think, could be released with a double click. I think the American press could escape the deadening uniformity, resist the herd instinct, check power with truth, reject manipulation, and altogether respect the spirit of liberty. Justice Leonard Hand defined as the spirit that is not too sure it is right, the spirit of liberty that seeks to understand the minds of other men and other women, that weighs their interests alongside its own without bias. Can it be the greatest organ for social reform? It's important to everybody in journalism around the world because America is the laboratory of what freedom may achieve. And it's no good arguing if freedom is achieving nothing. I want to conclude by a quote. 100 years ago, my book's called The American Century, that's how I came across this. Henry Adams was so dazzled by the velocity of change in America at the turn of the century that he made a prediction. And writing in that very off-putting conditional tense of his, in his biography, he said, at the rate of progress since 1800, every American who lived to the year 2000 would live to the year 2000. Would know how to control unlimited power. He would think in complexities unimaginable to an earlier mind. He would deal with problems altogether beyond the range of earlier society. To him, the 19th century would stand on the same plane with the 4th century, equally childlike, and he would only wonder how both of them, knowing so little and so weak in force, should have done so much. It could just happen. Ask me back in 2050. Thank you.
We've now got about a quarter of an hour questions and answers. There should be a roving mic downstairs and a roving mic upstairs. So I invite questions from the audience, and I'll leave Harry to pick the questioners.
Anybody I recognise, don't ask a question. Oh, yes, sir. Yes, madam. You, madam, with the pink scarf, suggesting liberal sympathies. Okay. I'd like to begin a lecture on public relations. Got another 30 minutes? There's a limit to what you can say, even when you gallop along. American public relations is highly sophisticated, as you know. I've not traced any of the effects of manipulation through the public relations, either good or bad, in this. I've been mainly concerned with the legal and the press lassitude in the face of it. Do you have any specific angle you want me to tackle?
Well, I'm particularly interested in the idea that you say that the press has been, I love your soundbite. You seem to be skating over the idea that media proliferation has anything to do with a downgrade.
I didn't mention public relations.
No, but I think you should have done.
Okay. I'm guilty, I'm sorry. If we start talking about public relations, we've got to go into instances and details of good public relations, bad public relations. I don't have any. To me, it's not a religion. I don't either. I judge it by its effectiveness and its results. If you want to say that a lot of the sins that I've been describing are due to public relations, or the public relations may be the solution, we could debate that. But I don't think it comes to the heart of what I've been talking about, which is what journalism can do. And by journalism, I mean inquiring minds full of curiosity, backed by... Incensed. Okay, well, the journalists here can respond to that. I mean, anybody else? Sir, in the back there with the beard. You have a beard? Yeah. I'm only using it for purposes of identification. There's no pejorative note.
I'm sorry, they don't seem to be any roving mics. They rove somewhere else, so I think everyone needs to shout, really.
The acoustics are not very good.
Why don't you come down a bit towards the front so people upstairs could also hear them?
The latest survey on, we're asking about the power of the press, has it been diminished by some of these examples? Oh, yes, it has, because the esteem of the press by the public eye is less than it's ever been. However, I have to say this, that Americans get most of their news from the press. They don't get it from the web. 11% are taking news directly from the web, 72% taking it from national television, 70% local television, and 66% from the printed media. And I think myself that, bear in mind that cyberspace is full of fraud and invention and lie, I think the press, provided it does its job properly, will come to be regain some esteem because it's a useful filter. Standards of accuracy count. You can upbraid the Wall Street Journal for making an error, and the New York Times. The New York Times carries corrections. So I think the prestige and credibility of those great organs will survive this crisis I've described, because I think there is a reawakening. I mean, the names I gave you are only a few. A reawakening of the importance of protecting these credible voices. When only you go on the howling wilderness of cyberspace and you read something, you're not sure whether it's true or not. Nobody except X from Minnesota is attaching his name to it. I mean, I use. Have you ever got a thing called /.com or /.? /.'s worth looking at sometime. It's a huge chat room. For instance, and they're claiming great things for it. Jane Ships had an article it wanted to test out, so it gave it to /.. /.. printed it, and thousands, I think 70,000 comments came in, and then it amended the article and checked it out by checking the source. So that kind of thing is very, very helpful. But at the end of the day, the authority lies with Jane's publication. You know, I think that... we could go on for a long time about the web. But I think that although the press has suffered in public trust, I would personally rather believe what I read in the New York Times, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, USA Today, than I would if I plugged in and read something about, let's say I plugged in and it said, Northern Ireland's peace efforts were wrecked by so-and-so and so-and-so, said this person, the Northern Ireland peace letter yesterday. We have no idea of its credibility. Journalists are useful.
But?
Well, in the United States, or here, well, there's much more variety of opinion in the UK than there is in the US. Variety of opinion, much more dissonance. Some of it's shallowly based, but nonetheless, it's there. And if you do what I try to do, which is to read all the weeklies, read the leading papers, look at a little bit of television, and go on the web occasionally,
you may possibly think, well, I think I've got a general idea now of what's going on. Right. Well, you could always pick up the phone and go and ask somebody. In the United States, you could pick up the phone almost and get through to the governor or the president and say, is it true that, you know? Yes, sir, over there, young fellow.
You talked a little about the internet in the speech. You just addressed it now. I have a slightly different question in the same vein. Could you please kind of assess the legacy of Matt Drudge, the Drudge Report, and then how Fox picked him up and gave him a show, gave him legitimacy in a sense, and then Fox missed him?
You know, Matt Drudge is a really celebrated figure now. And of course, he scooped everybody on the Lewinsky, at least the beginnings of the Lewinsky thing. I was in Washington for that. Matt Drudge has lost some credibility by printing. He freely says, I don't know whether it's true or not, just print it. So, and one of my complaints was that newspapers were picking up and saying, according to Matt Drudge, the earth is flat. And so there's an increased skepticism about it. Now, there's a learning process. We've gone through a revolution. We're still going through it about how to use this brilliant, wonderful, marvelous revolutionary tool effectively. So Matt Drudge is... I don't tune into Matt Drudge now. Mr. Drudge, are you anywhere? He's probably picking it up in cyberspace. He's going to haunt me for the rest of my life. Yes, sir. Was somebody over there? Yes, sir.
When I worked in the States, I was always...
That's a good point, but that's exactly what's been bothering me. And there must be some professional American journalists here tonight. Well, I think it's increased. When were you there?
20 years ago.
20 years ago. Well, I think, no, it's interesting. You see, this. I don't know. I honestly don't know. I mean, I can just guess. They normally are encouraging the journalism colleges to be skeptical. The better papers I saw in the regions were, but I think this what's been happening in the Clinton affair, the nuclear testing, the Arlington Cemetery, the Challenger disaster, an enormous amount of Panglossian enthusiasm allied to a kind of, how can I put it, partisanship. You know, Clinton is, all the people... Many, many, many people hate Clinton, so they're prepared to believe the worst about him. Yes, sir.
To my recollection, the anti-Clinton charge was actually led not by the lawyers, but by the Wall Street Journal.
The Wall Street Journal, yes, is one of those forces. Tubin's book, which is not out here yet, is much more detailed than I can be tonight, about the different levels and individuals who were involved. Now, the Wall Street Journal, of course, has been absolutely, and I'll say this, I hope I get picked, have been outrageous. When I said that the Whitewater land scandal, so-called, was repudiated by Jay Stevenson, the Wall Street Journal, it still goes on saying the same thing. The Wall Street Journal has been absolutely vehement of anti-Clinton. In fact, the Wall Street Journal, just now I come to think of it, when I was writing editorials in U.S. News and World Report in 1984, was saying there's no such thing as global warming, and I kept all the stuff. And it's still saying there's no such thing as... They're out there on the last ice floe. Yes, sir.
Are there any prospects for a diminution of the parochial
Well, you're absolutely right. That is quite true. I've not remarked on it tonight. It's a great country, and we all depend on American leadership one way or another. And yet the insularity in my time since 1984 has increased. When I look at a news magazine, just conventionally, which used to have 12 to 14 pages of foreign news, it may have 4. And only in a great crisis like Somalia, Mogadishu, or Kosovo, but even then kind of belatedly. I mean, America's so, bearing in mind that there's great gaps between the rich and the poor, but nonetheless, it's still so prosperous. The tendency to look inward into that continent, despite globalization, is still intense. And we've got to run him for president or something. So But the Americans are using the web, and I think we're seeing a change. I think the web's going to make a huge difference to it, and that will filter back to the newspapers probably. But by and large, the foreign reporting in the British press, in quantity, is greater. The New York Times is still doing a pretty good job of reporting the world. I mean, Warren Hogue in London has been a wonderful job on reporting Northern Ireland. There've been various other correspondents who've done extremely well, and I'm thinking of. For instance, some of the Latin American reporting of the massacres in Salvador have been extremely well done. So there have been some great instances of by isolated papers and magazines. In New York has been extremely good on foreign reporting and still is. David Remnick, who's now the editor, is a great correspondent. But the general tendency in the Midwest and the Far West, and when I pick up the papers at regional airports, is not to expect to find anything about Kimoi and Matsu or England. For that matter, finding out what goes on in England is sometimes I have to read the British press. Yes.
And they say that we used to be 10 years behind America, and now it's something like 2 years. Do you think the British press is going down the same route?
Oh, I tell you what, I don't think so at the moment, because there seem to be so many rich men who want to own newspapers. And the British journalists are kind of a bit more cussed, I think, in their attitude. I think we are behind America. The British press is behind America in the technological sense and the revolution, the way the web is being used, and in the manufacturing and other processes, and in the proliferation of a genuine plurality of news outlets is occurring. Some of it's absolutely terrible, but they, you know, it's there at least. Yes, sir, back. I'm sorry, is anybody up here? Oh, yeah, could I have one from the balcony?
Shout, no, good.
Right, can you hear me down there?
Yes.
I was very interested in your comments about the homogenization of the American press. And one of the things I wondered about was whether with the immense amount of television coverage that there is in America, whether there has become, in a sense, a belief in the American media, that somehow the media are real life. Therefore, they, in a sense, match each other and report each other and use each other's sources in a way which makes the reality of the facts become increasingly irrelevant. That there's, in some way, at a subconscious level, a confusion between media and reality.
That's very profound. I'd make that a PhD if I were you. I get what you're saying. It's happened in the Clinton thing that sources, it was like fleas on lesser fleas, quoting source, because everybody was such a frenzy not to be left behind. That happened there. There is a bit of that tendency to live off what other people have found. You know, it's very hard to get up your seat and go into the steel factory or the rubber works and ask direct questions and so on. The more we can encourage people to do that, the regional reporting, the better. Actually, it's getting terribly easy to be a reporter in some ways, because you can sit there and tap in a couple of words on the web, you get a sort of series of stuff and you print it, or at least you rewrite it, you know. That's a very great danger. I think the web's a greater danger of discouraging shoe leather reporting, because you can get so much without doing it. One more question. Go on, I'll be quick. Well, I support Sullivan, and we're all glad about it, but it's been corrupted. And I've just come from being editorial director of a tabloid newspaper, so I'm involved. I've been involved in great detail on can we say this about so-and-so, and can we say this about so-and-so. And there was this conference in New York, was on Sullivan v. New York Times, about 4 weeks ago, and Greenfield of ABC spoke, I spoke, and the Roy Floyd Abrams spoke, and the audience, which mainly consisted of defense lawyers, using Sullivan to justify defamations. But they were appalled to find that most of the people speaking, the four of us speaking, were all anxious, and there's now a great anxiety. The question is, there have been some judgments in the law courts recently which have been pushing back on Sullivan. And in the federal courts, the standard has still been maintained that you can say almost anything about anybody unless you can prove malice. So I have great caution about Sullivan, and if we ever get to a state in England where we can do what Alan Rushbridge has suggested, exchanging privacy law in return for greater access, I think it would be to a benefit. I do not see any great journalistic benefit apart from the massive entertainment we all have for the amount of misery caused by some of the intrusions that go on. I just don't see any benefit to us from it. And I think this is the journalists I've mentioned in America feel this as much as anybody. I'd love to take more questions, but you're all exhausted and you've been very patient.
I'm afraid we do have to draw to a close. I noticed quite a few hands hovering in the air. For anyone who'd like to pursue Harry Evans a bit more, there is a reception up on the fifth floor of the old building, and you can find a guide to take you there. And he'll be there for a while, and I hope perhaps we'll answer other questions that people have. In the meantime, can I say thanks to him for coming? Lovely lecture, really. Really good occasion for the LSE. Thanks very much, Harry.
I say, this is one occasion on which I welcome unanimity. This is one occasion in which I welcome unanimity. Thank you.